You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 4th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Bruce Afron. He is one of two attorneys representing five plaintiffs, six plaintiffs, in a challenge to the National Defense Authorization Act. Some of those plaintiffs: Chris Hedges, Noam Chomsky, Daniel Ellsberg. We will be speaking to him about their first day in court last Thursday. Also on the program today, we'll get to that GOP operative came to see Jesus. Well, the gay Jesus. And also the unbelievable havoc wreaked upon the military by Don't Ask, Don't Tell's repeal, or I should say the complete lack of unbelievable havoc wreaked upon the military because of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The real Romney. Fox News tweeting out and linking to stories about President Obama, not just that, of course, he's not an American citizen, but the nefarious plots that he was involved in to hide that secret. We're going to blow the lid off that today, ladies and gentlemen. Also, some interesting stories, not only about the FDA and the Obama administration's politicization of the FDA, but also an opportunity for the FDA to redeem itself in some respects, and how it relates to pink slime. What is pink slime, you ask? It's in your burgers. All right, but first up, before we get there, today is the anniversary. 44 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. He was in Memphis, Tennessee, joining, the union workers of AFSCME, sanitation workers who were on strike in Memphis, which had started about 2 or 3 months before in February. And this is relevant because this was at a time where we're starting to see Martin Luther King turn from, well, not necessarily turn from civil rights, but broadening his sense of what constituted civil rights. And he was becoming more active in fighting poverty and in fighting for the rights of workers. I want to play just a clip of a documentary or a short news piece that was done on it years ago. Let's listen to this just to remind you on the anniversary of his death, just where Martin Luther King was heading. And it's relevant particularly in the context of what we're seeing from our government in attempts to suppress protest. Let's play this clip now.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
On March 28th, Dr. Martin Luther King led a march here in Memphis in support of the sanitation workers. This is one of the few times when his staff did not organize the march. Some of the young people saw this as an opportunity to demonstrate their frustration and what they considered the slowness with which the community leadership was moving. They began to break out windows and disrupt the march. This gave the policemen an opportunity to move in to break up the march in an effort to discredit Dr. Martin Luther King and the local leadership.
As when we came back downtown the following day, really to be confronted with tanks and half tracks and jeeps and National Guardmen with bayonets all over the place, it really sort of provided the classic kind of confrontation between striking workers with nothing more than a picket sign and really what was the might of the armed forces of this city. And it was frightening in one aspect, and where the least bit of wrong action could really have triggered a situation that would have been tragic for many people.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for rights.
Okay, and that was Martin Luther King. The next day, he was assassinated. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to civil rights attorney Bruce Affron, representing the plaintiffs suing the government over the National Defense Authorization Act, the so-called Homeland Battlefield Law. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Bruce Affron, he is a professor of law at Rutgers University, a civil rights attorney and constitutional attorney. He, you may recognize his name from his lawsuit against the telecom, some telecom players in the NSA spying case during the Bush years. He is representing plaintiffs in an action against the National Defense Authorization Act. Welcome to the program, Bruce.
Thank you, Sam. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So lay out exactly who the plaintiffs are and what the what exactly are you suing the government for?
Well, we have a variety of plaintiffs. Chris Hedges, the well-known Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, is our lead plaintiff. Dan Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Jennifer Boland, who's a young activist from Revolution Truth, Alexa O'Brien, who's one of the leaders of the Occupy movement, and U.S. Day of Rage, an Icelandic parliamentarian, Brigadir Jonsdottir, who has been subpoenaed and investigated by the U.S. in connection with WikiLeaks, and finally a young woman from England, Kaiwagala, who is one of the leaders of Occupy London. And all of them will be brought under this law, which makes it an offense simply to give substantial support to some group that the government deems associated with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. There's no definition in the law, and any one of these people, because of their associations, like millions of people, could potentially be brought under the law.
Okay, so before we break that down, because we're talking about a couple of specific sections of this National Defense Authorization or Homeland Battlefield Law. What is it exactly that the plaintiffs are seeking here? To overturn this law?
Well, we're seeking two things. Ultimately, to overturn the law because it's unconstitutional in that it would put civilians and citizens into military detention, and because it's unconstitutionally vague. It doesn't tell anyone what does it mean to substantially support and who are the associated groups. And more immediately, we're asking the court to put a temporary stay on the law until it can be fully addressed in court.
And on last Thursday, there was a hearing, essentially to deal with the issue of standing, whether or not the plaintiffs have the ability to challenge this law. Is that right?
That's essentially the issue at this stage, you know, whether they have a close enough connection to the scope of the law to give them the right to be in court. And I'm pretty convinced that the judge sees that as already present based on her comments. You know, the next question would be, you know, how far does she have to go at this stage to prevent the law from having this harm before there's a full hearing?
Okay, so let's go into, and we're talking here about sections 1021 and 1022 of the law. But let's first tell us, the first plaintiff to testify was Alexa O'Brien. You mentioned her, that she is involved in the Occupy movement. She co-founded the U.S. Day of Rage. Tell us about her story and why that why she would have standing in your eyes to challenge this law.
Well, Alexa O'Brien founded U.S. Day of Rage, which is really a campaign finance group. And as soon as she became active, she was contacted by various security vendors who provide services to the U.S., suggesting she's linked with Islamic Jihad, informing her that her group has now appeared on Islamic Jihad websites. Department of Homeland Security actually put her on an alert, her group on an alert, along with Occupy and Al-Qaeda. And so these contacts have just come out of the blue towards her and her group, which make one clearly think that they're targets of a government government terrorism investigation. And that puts her in reasonable fear of being put into indefinite detention.
And it, because it because of the wording of the law in section 1021, she could be seen as either substantially supporting Al-Qaeda or as associated forces, because maybe their protest movement were being sort of featured on a website that is associated with Al-Qaeda. Is that it?
Well, the government has put her on an investigation, and these security experts who work on contract with the government have been contacting her as part of their investigation. So we think she's already targeted, or her group is already targeted, to be a substantially supporting group and thus would be brought under the law. So we think she has standing to bring this challenge.
Okay, and so the next witness was Kai Wargala, and she is a member of Occupy London. What was her story that made that would argue to her being having standing in this case?
Well, Kai is a very interesting person. She's studying for a master's degree in Germany, but is living in England while she writes a thesis. She's one of the founders of Occupy London. And Occupy London was put on a terrorist watch list by the Metropolitan Police of the City of London, right under Al-Qaeda. You know, there are four groups listed, and they're the fourth, just under Al-Qaeda. And so clearly, Occupy London has been targeted already by the host government as associated with Al-Qaeda. So we think that Kai and her organization could be brought under the scope of this law. That's how broad it is. And there's absolutely no definitions to limit its application.
And then Chris Hedges spoke. Why? What's the argument that he has standing under the law?
Well, Chris has been in contact with many, many terrorist organizations, insurgent organizations as a war correspondent. He hasn't been on the field with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban because they're in conflict with the U.S., but he's been on the field with many other groups, including Hamas. He's actually been at the home of one of the leaders of Hamas, Rantizi, before he was killed in an Israeli attack. And so Hedges is someone who has associated with dozens of people who the government normally regards as terrorists. Now, he doesn't associate with them outside of his role as a journalist, as a war correspondent. But those associations are so close that we think he could be linked. In addition, he's been detained several times by the U.S., once by the military in Saudi Arabia, the U.S. military, for working outside of the press pool, which they had no legal right to do since he was admitted by the Saudi government, and once in the U.S. where he was told he was on a watch list. And the only thing the government puts people on a watch list for is some linkage with some terrorist group. Now, Chris is a journalist. He's never had any linkage with any terrorist group except in his work, and that's why this ordinance will invoke First Amendment rights and privileges. And so Chris is a plaintiff because of the government's own actions towards him during his work as a journalist.
Now, we've established at least, or there's an attempt to be established, that these people have standing under law and can bring this case. There was an interesting exchange between the district judge, Catherine Forrest, and the government lawyer as to the scope of these things. In other words, you know, what the definition of substantially supported means, or what the definition of associated forces means. Tell us about that, because it's rather, it sort of speaks to the heart of what is problematic about this law.
You know, I should, before I forget, just mention my lead co-counsel, Carl Mayer, has been on this with me from the beginning. We're also assisted by David Neems. But Carl and I have spearheaded this, and we sat there dumbfounded as the government refused, by my count, six times to answer the judge's questions. Each time she asked, well, doesn't the work of Chris Hedges, doesn't the tie-in of the police with Wargala, doesn't O'Brien's contacts by the government, from the government, reasonably make them targets? And can you say that their expressive conduct will not bring them under the law? And six times the government attorneys refused to answer.
And by that, they literally answered. They simply said, we can't say that. They said, we have no answer for you, essentially.
They said, we cannot answer. We are not permitted to answer.
Oh, so they were answering. So the definitions of this law are secret as opposed to unknown.
Well, the definitions don't exist. It's the government's interpretation that they're keeping secret. And, you know, that's really the crux of the constitutional issue, that if you can't see what the law means from its plain language, and there are no definitions and no limiting provisions, then it obviously touches First Amendment activity. And that's what the judge was asking, and six times the government refused to give the judge an assurance that their expressive activities would not bring them under the statute. Finally, the judge said, I'm going to have difficulty finding this to be constitutional if the government can't give me any answer like that. If the government can't give an assurance that expressive conduct is not going to bring them under the statute. So it was a fascinating exchange.
Yeah, that's amazing, because there is really no way to know. And the argument, at least from Chris Hedges, is this is going to have a tremendous chilling effect, because if I don't know where that line is, if I don't know that I fall under this law, if I interview a leader of Hamas, then I'm not going to do it for fear of being detained by the military for an indefinite period of time.
Well, and actually, Naomi Wolf, who's a well-known journalist, has said that she, you know, may want to join the case precisely because of that factor, that she's already held back on some journalistic interviews of this nature because of fear of the law. You know, Chris Hedges has said he will not be silenced in the work he does, but he's already been forced to change how he interviews people. He's unwilling to interview certain people by phone and has to actually go and see them personally to do his work. And so this burdens expressive conduct. Someone like Alexei O'Brien, who's essentially a private citizen, you know, working as a journalist on occasion, is now in a position where she fears being detained indefinitely simply for writing about issues involving people in Guantanamo, because the government has already flagged her group as associated with these organizations. This is an immense threat to the First Amendment. It's these types of vague laws that undermine democracy.
So is this, I mean, ultimately, if the plaintiffs are found to have standing and the case goes forward, is the challenge going to be on its chilling effect on the First Amendment, on its encroachment? I mean, what specifically, you know, help us, those of us who either went to only law school for 1 year or didn't go to law school at all. Specifically, what aspects of the law will you argue are unconstitutional? Will you focus simply on the First Amendment issues, or are there other ones?
Well, there are two. And actually, most legal issues are not terribly complex. Sometimes lawyers make them sound that way. Really, the law says anyone who substantially supports any group associated with al-Qaeda can be subject to indefinite military detention without trial, and even move to foreign governments, to foreign countries. That's the first thing, because those words substantially supported and associated forces are so vague as to mean virtually anything to anyone. And the government's refusal to assure Judge Forrest that expressive activity is not within that category and that their association by the government with al-Qaeda will not bring them under it demonstrates how broad and dangerous it is. So it's that substantially supporting language, which is not defined, associated forces, which could mean virtually any group that the government deems associated in spirit even, will bring these people under it and many others. The second point is that it has never been recognized by our courts that a citizen can be put into military custody if they're not engaged in armed conflict against the U.S. This law allows civilians and citizens who are not engaged in any combat with the United States to be put in military custody. The Supreme Court in the Hamdi decision in 2004 said that only where a citizen is engaged in actual armed conflict with the U.S. can they be subject to military detention. As far back as the Civil War, the Supreme Court held the government cannot put a citizen into military custody. And so the statute on the second ground, that it presumes it can take a citizen who's not in the military, who's not in a conflict with the U.S., but is simply engaged in First Amendment activity and put them in military custody, that violates one of the most sacred principles of our court system.
And was that specifically addressed by the government attorneys, that second grounds?
The government has virtually ignored that argument. They've pretended it doesn't exist. We have addressed it at great length, and the government's briefs are virtually silent on this point because there's no answer to it. The Supreme Court has clearly stated a citizen cannot be put in military custody. And the government, you know, has simply been silent on the question.
At one point, I think the judge said, "Are you telling me that no U.S. citizen can be detained under 1021?" And the government lawyer simply said, "Well, that's not a reasonable fear." And when the judge continued on, "Say it's reasonable to fear you will be unlucky and face detention trial." What does directly supported mean? And we've not said anything about that, said the government attorney. So how is it that we hear from – there are some legal experts. There are certainly politicians who voted for this act that it doesn't allow for U.S. citizens to be detained. How is it that we hear that?
Because people gloss over what politicians and presidents say. The judge pointed to the president's signing statement, and the judge pointed this on our own before I said nothing about this, and yet the judge said, look at President Obama's signing statement. It only says citizens will not be subject to military detention without trial under the act. And she pointed out to the government, this doesn't say citizens won't be arrested and put into military custody. It simply says they won't be put into military custody without trial. So the judge herself said to the government, the president's signing statement does not even protect citizens from being brought into military custody. And the government had no answer.
That's aside now. I should make this clear. The law passed. The president signs a signing statement, which is essentially an expression of his intent on how the law will be executed. But that's not necessarily binding. It's certainly not necessarily binding on future presidents. And is it in any way?
It's not binding even on President Obama. He's free to change his mind. And, in fact, the signing statement does not say citizens won't be arrested under this law. It simply says they won't be put in military custody without a trial. But they can still be put, even under the president's signing statement, into military detention. And that's one of the fundamental wrongs, that a citizen should be tried only in a proper federal court with proper due process protection.
So is the implication from that signing statement that we won't militarily detain anyone without some form of trial? We won't say what that trial – I mean, is the implication that the trial is a military commission? Is the implication a trial in a civilian court? And then it seems to me the implication is also is that they are asserting one way or another that there is the authority to militarily detain people.
Oh, it's worse than that, Sam. Section 1022 governs the capturing of foreigners in foreign countries. Congress, in passing that section, ordered that the president set up rules governing their detention and their trial in a military commission. As to Section 1021, which is what governs citizens in the U.S., Congress did not require that any rules be created. And even as of this date, there are no rules. So the president's signing statement does not stop citizens from being taken into the military. His signing statement is not even binding on him, much less later presidents. And there are no regulations to protect American citizens, even though Congress paradoxically ordered that there be regulations to protect foreigners taken in foreign countries.
Is the fact that Congress ordered for specific regulations about foreigners an indication that the Congress didn't quite know what it was passing? I mean, in other words, that they presumed that under this law, civilians would not be able to be detained by the military, but because of the way that it was written, that it provided for that?
It's not clear what Congress understood. The way these laws are passed, they are rushed through. They're drafted very quickly. It was tacked on to the military appropriations bill. Very little thought was given to it, and it was rushed through as a political act. And so, like the Patriot Act before it, there is virtually no thought given to most members of Congress as to these implications. It's an extraordinarily serious step to suggest that citizens can be put into military custody, to suggest that anyone can be, unless they're in an armed conflict. And yet very little thought was given by Congress to the step. That's what is so tragic about our modern system of legislation. I will say this. There are Republicans in Congress right now who are introducing this week changes to the law to eliminate many of these problems. And so there's now going to be, there's now a backlash, and hopefully this will get legislatively addressed. But at the moment, this is a grossly unconstitutional and very violative act. It's still on the books.
And so what happens next in the legal case?
Well, we're submitting briefs. The judge, you know, enough issues arise, both factually and legally, that the judge wanted additional briefs. We had a full-day hearing, fascinating legal argument, but now we have additional briefs that are due within the next 2 weeks. At that point, the judge will decide whether she will put an injunction on the law and to what extent. She might issue an injunction only as to expressive activities and leave the statute standing. You know, our position is that that gives a measure of protection, of course, but where the law is so vague that it allows for the possibility of arrests for First Amendment activity, the law itself should be declared unconstitutional and let Congress rewrite it. Sam, I should say that we're only dealing with a very small part of this law. You know, one small section. None of our challenge has anything to do with people who are in a combatancy with the U.S., who are arrested on a battlefield. We're dealing only with a very small section dealing with people in this country who are civilians.
I'm sorry, if she was to provide injunctive relief for expressive activities, what is the scope of expressive activities?
Well, that's what we were wrestling with in court. And it's a very difficult thing to define because expressive activities are almost endless. There are interviews with people in terrorist organizations. There's commentary that discusses their ideology. There are protests that end up being associated by governments with Islamic groups. And the range of expression is endless, which is really why Congress needs to take care when it writes these laws. You know, I'll point out one thing. In the 1996 Act, Congress banned material support for terrorist groups, and it defined it very, very, very specifically. And that's constitutional because there are clear definitions. Here, Congress rushed it through and didn't even bother incorporating those definitions into this law. And so we have to say to ourselves, well, if Congress doesn't put these definitions in, it must be intending to regulate more conduct, more expressive activity. And that's why this new law was passed.
I was going to ask you, I mean, because it's not often that I have a constitutional law professor on the phone, but if we've established in the past that money is speech, how is it such that if I was to donate money to Hamas, that would be considered material support as opposed to simply expressive activity?
Well, obviously not all speech is constitutionally protected. If you give money to an organized crime syndicate to purchase weaponry, clearly that is not speech, first of all. If you give money to Hamas that just goes into a Hamas treasury and they use that to buy weapons, Congress can regulate that type of donation. If you give money to a Hamas hospital, it's less clear whether or not that's outside of the First Amendment and outside of associative activity. You know, I would say this. None of our clients endorse giving any financial support or assistance to any terrorist group.
Of course.
And we as lawyers don't. This is about the contacts to inform the world of their activities and about ideas that, you know, trade around all of these conflicts. Our clients don't necessarily agree with these groups, but as journalists believe, the public needs to be informed. That can't be done unless one sees these people and is free to interview them. You know, so I would say there's a vast difference between speaking to people and reporting on them and giving money to help a group like that, which clearly can be banned.
So briefs go in 2 weeks, and then do you have a sense of what the timeline is for the judge to consider this? And secondarily, is there any chance that we're going to see a quashing of this case because of some type of state secret doctrine or some such?
Well, as to the first question, I think the judge will decide sometime in May.
Okay.
Because it's a preliminary injunction proceeding, and normally they're handled fairly quickly. If she denies that, the case will simply go to trial, you know, some months later on the main issue. It won't get dismissed. As far as, you know, whether it could be quashed on state secrets grounds, that's the government's second line of defense in all these cases. First, they say the plaintiffs have no standing. Secondly, they say if they have standing, sorry, judge, we can't discuss this case because of state secrets. Even in the NSA cases, the district judge, Vaughn Walker, in California, rejected that argument. He said, there's no reason we can't discuss the legal issues. And so that case will proceed against the government. You know, in this situation, I don't see that as happening because the statute is the issue. It's not their policies.
Right. Interesting. There's no facts in contention. There's nothing that needs to be revealed about what's going on. We're simply arguing as to the validity of the law.
I think that's very well said. Precisely.
Well, Professor Bruce Afrin and the attorney for representing these plaintiffs in this suit about the National Defense Authorization Act, I appreciate you taking the time today.
Oh, thank you, Sam. I'm glad to be here.
All right, folks. Yeah, let's end it early today. And we're going to give a bonus for members. And for non-members, you don't get it. You will not be able to hear me apologize to someone in the better half of the show. Even Matt looked at me like, what? An apology? Yes. I owe someone an apology. And I will offer that in the better half of the program. You can also call in at 646-257-3920. I offer it in the better half of the program because that's where my offense took place. Also in the better half, we'll be talking about this Republican GOP operative who fought to deny gay people equal rights, now fighting to get those rights back because she's now gay. Still a Republican, though. We'll also talk about this pink slime and dig a little deeper into the politicization of the FDA and some very interesting policy questions. Not only studies that show curbing female reproductive rights, the Republican, agenda du jour. Not only does that increase taxpayer costs, but also how Medicare is trying to increase people's health, Medicaid, and also decrease taxpayer costs in terms of early births. And Santa Monica college students engaging in that expressive activity get pepper spray in their faces for it. All that and more in the better half of the program. And just a programming note, tomorrow is Thursday, but not on the Majority Report. Tomorrow, Thursday's Casual Friday. And Friday will be Normal Thursday. For this week only. So make sure you tune in. Isabel Gillies apparently will have two theme songs tomorrow. All right. You can IM me at Majority FM or call me at 646-257-3920.